Okay, this week's Parsha is Parshas Vayetze, Vayetze Yaakov Be'er Sheva. Jacob left from the town of Be'er Sheva. The title called Don't Hate. And the ideas were gleaned from Rabbi Sachs, my Rabbi Yoni Sachs, my Chavrus, as well as our collective teacher, Rabbi Reuven Mann. So I'm going to share a video. Obviously, let's start with a video. I'm going to share a screen. Just give me a second here. Okay. Dan, do you see the screen?
Yes.
Let me go. This is a Hello Newman compilation. All right, so that's a classic. And, check out the sheet over here. You see the sheet?
Yes.
All right, so what is Jerry Seinfeld's attitude toward Newman?
I would say that he finds him extremely irritating.
Right. And he's exactly, he's on the edge of just basically yelling at him. You know, he's sort of seething. Which, of course, you think there was some history behind his attitude. What kind of event between friends would cause his attitude?
Yeah, though I thought in this instance it was not so much one specific event and just a history of generally being very annoying. So, to me, it feels like this reflects just, yeah, there's some people that just really get under your skin.
So is it,
yeah, so
now is his aggression toward him, his negativity toward him, only because he finds him extremely grating as a person? Or would it suggest, if it's prolonged, that there was some sort of issue, which I don't think in the show they ever referenced, by the way, there's something
right.
that he harmed him in some sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this reflects not, again, a specific event that happened in the deep past that was awful, but rather that this is just one of these people that, yeah, just whenever you see the person, it's just, it's like the nails on the chalkboard.
Now he's,
that is the tone.
But the question is, so then why is he not to simply ignore him?
Because again, you can't ignore that sound. You know, he's always in his life, right? They live in the same building or whatever. He's
right,
always in his friends.
Away.
Kramer,
right.
Always showing.
Right. They're all there.
Showing up. He's always.
Right. He's woven into the fabric of social life.
Yeah, right. So, you know, it's like he's part of the effective family in this instance, you know, so.
Which is how appropriate.
Their family is the people that.
Which is a time when families get together, families and extended families.
Right.
And there's something that always arises. That, you know, the cousin or the uncle that people feel just can't stand.
Right.
So,
yeah.
we have a situation where this situation would arise even among the couple. You have the situation.
Yeah, a romantic couple, you're saying?
Yeah.
It's not a good formula for long-term success of the relationship, is what I would say. I don't know if this can be resolved, really. Well, I'm sorry, I didn't even say that was the fourth question, but it seems like, yes, if this is your spouse, if you have this attitude about your spouse, it's unlikely. I can't imagine you have a successful resolution. So, I mean, again, that's under your skin. You know, there's a bug crawling under your skin. That's the attitude when you see this person.
You can have this. So there are two. What we really have identified, there are two situations. There is a person who is part of your life who intrinsically, on a personality level, just gets under your skin like nails on a chalkboard.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be able to start enjoying that person because there's a complete lack of rapport here. There's no connectivity whatsoever. But then you can have a situation where you have a friendship or even a couple where they obviously at one point got along fantastically. Something happened. Now the dynamic has changed. You know what I mean? That's also very common. Where there's some sort of situation where somebody said an embarrassing story in front of others, and the person feels very slighted and feels insulted. But they don't ever talk about it. They just are passively aggressive about it. That's also extremely common. You know what I mean?
There's
no attempt to even discuss it. It's sort of like, and they just sort of work around the new normal. But I agree with you. If that's a couple, that situation is going to be, very short term. All right. If you can read this, so this is sort of like the tail end of last week's parsha and the beginning of this week's parsha. So if you can read from 27:41.
Esau was furious at Yaakov because of the blessing that his father had given him. He said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father will be here soon. I will then be able to kill my brother Yaakov." Her older son's plans were reported to Rivka. She sent word and summoned her younger son Yaakov. "Your brother Esau is consoling himself by planning to kill you," she said. "Now, my son, listen to me. Set out and flee to my brother Laban in Haran. Remain with him a while until your brother's anger has subsided. When your brother has calmed down from his rage against you and has forgotten what you have done to him, I will send word and summon you home. But why should I lose you both on the same day?" Rivka said to Isaac, "I am disgusted with life because of those Hittite women. If Yaakov marries such a Hittite girl from the daughters of this land, why should I go on living?"
Right. And then the parsha opens up, in fact, that Yitzchak agrees with Rivka, and the opening verse of the parsha.
Keep reading. Yaakov left Beersheba and went towards Haran.
Right. So he flees. Now, what people often forget, I just realized it this year, is that, in other words, here we have Esau wants to, because Yaakov deceiving of his brother Yitzchak and getting the blessing instead of him, which of course is a question, you know what does that mean? And I've done that class before. And it's on Yom Torah. But so obviously he's so angry at that, he can only think of one resolution. And what is that? Esau has only one resolution of the issue of Jacob stealing the blessing. And from before that, it's stealing, compounding on stealing the right of the firstborn. And what's Esau's solution?
The solution is to kill.
Now, why didn't he kill him now?
Sorry, why? I just didn't hear. Why doesn't he kill him now?
Why doesn't Esau kill Yaakov right now?
Oh, I guess that's the mystery, I suppose. I mean, the literal reading is that he never does anything that bad, right? So
what's the stated reason? It says, the days of mourning of my father will be here soon. I will then be able to kill my brother Yaakov.
Yeah, no, but the thing is, if he's, you know, if he's a guy who's so much driven by the animal instinct, you know, there's no way that he would be able to, he would just act, he acts in the present. So, I mean, that's more of a calculated plan.
Right.
And so it flies in the face of this sense of him as, yeah, representing the it, pure it or whatever it is.
No, he's not so, the pure it. No, he's more sophisticated than that. Now, but what's the counterpoint is the exact point. Now, how close typically are brothers in a family?
How close?
Yeah, emotionally.
Oh, I don't know. I think it really depends is the answer. I don't know if there is. I don't know if there is a. If it, you can generalize this. Some are very close. I don't have a brother, number one, but right. Some are very close and some are not close at all. I mean, some are right. Strange. So it runs the whole gamut.
It does. Now, how about twins? Do they tend to be close?
Oh, you assume twins tend to be very close. Yeah.
Right. So we don't forget, even these are fraternal twins.
Right.
And that's a bit, so therefore the fact that he has given him not just a brotherly love, but the brotherly love that emerged from twins, that's a huge rejection that you want to plan to kill him. And the only thing stopping you is because, as the Radak says over here, he doesn't, he planned to kill Yaakov. He wished fervently for the day of his father's death. Okay, why? Which he was expected soon because his dad's very old. As why else why did he already bless his sons? He planned to kill Yaakov after the mourning period after his father would have passed. He did not want to kill Yaakov while their father was still alive, so as not to be responsible for mutually dying as a result of grief of having lost his son. So he had enough, what's called, sense of control that he didn't want to, you know, he be responsible for causing, his father to be harmed. And let's check out the Rashi here. Rashi says, your brother Esav has consoled himself by planning to kill you. He regrets the brotherly relationship existing between you, harboring thoughts other than those of brotherhood to estrange himself from you and kill you. And the Midrashic explanation, his eyes, he's already regarded, you are already regarded as dead, and he has drunk for you, he regards you as dead, the cup of consolation, which is customary for near relatives of the deceased to drink. Typically, in the time of the Tanakh, when you came back from the funeral, the first meal, what they call the Sudas HaBarah, which we typically have an egg and other foods, they'd also have a glass of wine. Part of the wine is to take off the edge. But according to the real meaning of the word, he'll recover himself for the loss of blessings by killing you. Okay. Now, let's weave it back together. So what keeps Jerry from simply not having any relationship with Newman? I think you answered that. Because basically he wove it into the very fabric of his existence.
And right.
And Radak, why was holding Isavet for murder? Basically he did not want to be the cause of his father's death. But now yeah. Okay. Here's a very big question, which is sort of a dramatic question. Why do Rivka and Yaakov not fear Esav of murderous anger before they hear the explicit plan? You know what I'm saying? They're planning to, in order that Rivka, Yaakov's mother, goes in collusion and brings Yaakov into the plan to steal the blessing, right? Why did they not calculate that by doing so, they're going to create such a murderous rage within Asa?
I guess maybe they don't think it's possible. It's a son or whatever. And so son and twin brother, maybe you think he wouldn't react. He'd get over it, whatever. He wouldn't react in that extreme way.
Right. It was like simply, it's so unnatural that she couldn't possibly anticipate that. Also really showing a sort of a naivete on her part. Now, later on, Rivka says she's going to call Yaakov when Esav's anger cools. Here's a key question. Does Esav's anger ever cool naturally? Does Aesop really just, you know something? Let bygones be got bygones. Does he ever, does it happen on its own? Does anger and aggression toward a person ever just naturally dissipate? Or at least in Aesop?
Yes. For sure. Yeah, of course. Definitely. Yeah. Some people, yes. Some people hold a grudge and some people don't. So, you know, time heals all wounds. Not in every single case, but yeah, generally the passage of time, life goes on and you get over it.
Right.
So in his case, it doesn't seem like that's not the example here necessarily, but
no,
for most people, yeah.
Well, you see, it does not, because next week's parsha of Vayishlah, Esav comes to greet, quote unquote, greet Yaakov with 400 men. So it seems that he maintained his position, his posture, for like 20, 30 years.
Right.
And Rivka never sends anybody to go to Haran to go fetch Yaakov to come on home. She initially thought it was going to be a short time, maybe a couple of months, 6 months, whatever, maybe a year. But it never happens, which is remarkable, which gets into the main issue, which is an interesting halacha, it's a halacha which on the surface seems like makes a lot of sense, but people are extremely resistant to do this mitzvah, which is, let's take a look, read it out. This is from the Rambam, Laws of Character Traits.
Okay, whoever hates a fellow Jew in his heart transgresses a Torah prohibition. Do not hate your brother in your heart. One is not liable for lashes for violating this prohibition because no deed is involved. The Torah only warns us against hating in our hearts. However, a person who beats a colleague or insults him, although he is not permitted to do so, does not violate the prohibition, you shall not hate.
You go on.
Okay, when one person wrongs another, the latter should not remain silent and despise him. As Samuel states concerning the wicked, and Avshalom did not speak to Amnon, neither good nor bad, for Avshalom hated Amnon. Rather, he is commanded to make the matter known and ask him, why did you do this to me? Matter. You shall surely admonish your colleague.
Right. And lastly, if the person who committed the wrong asked his colleague to forgive him, he must do so. A person should not be cruel when forgiving, as implied by Bereishis, and Avram prayed to God concerning Avimelech. So there's a mitzvah to, if a person has an issue, if a person felt slighted, insulted, harmed, there's a positive command not to hold it in, but he has to meet with the person and broker a reconciliation. And people are very loath to do that. People do not like doing that. So let's get a couple of questions here. Did Jerry violate the prohibition of hating a fellow Jew in his heart? Essentially, they're both Jewish. What would you say?
I think it's not clear to me he hates him. It's hard because it's the comedy element of it. So.
Right.
They don't really show, they don't want to make Jerry a mean character. And so hatred is not an appealing comment. It's not an appealing characteristic. So they're very careful, I think, not to show hatred. They show the annoyance. Annoyance is funny and hatred is not.
In that little clip, it says, when he describes Newman, he says, a person who in his heart is so dark, who would not appeal to any compassion and pity whatsoever. Who is that? Newman. Or he just views him as being like a super evil person for some crazy reason. Obviously, it's done for comedic effect, obviously. But just using it as a... Now, the question is, you could say that since he speaks... He just says, all he ever says to him in an aggressive way is he just says his word, his name, in an angry fashion. He doesn't actually say he hates them. He doesn't hit him. No, he doesn't insult him. The truth is, in other words, he makes it known that he hates him. The truth is, I would argue, he actually does not violate the mitzvah of hating your fellow Jew in your heart. Why? Because he's made it known that he can't stand him. In other words, he's not acting in a fake manner that he really likes him. He says that's the whole comedy. He sees him and he says, "Hello, Newman." You know what I mean? Clearly, in an aggressive way, he hates him. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Right. And so, but Newman hates Jerry too, right? It's a mutual thing.
Right. It's a mutual hatred. So, and as time goes on, we expect Jerry's relationship with Newman to get better or worse.
Well, maybe it stays the same. I mean, I don't know if he hates him more over time. It doesn't get better, obviously, but...
Right. Well, typically when there's aggression in the relationship and it's not resolved, it typically snowballs and gets worse and worse.
Right. But in this instance, you're saying there is a resolution because they were both communicating their hatred.
Right. They're not... The Torah prohibition, which we have to ask ourselves the obvious question is... the question is, why the Torah, if I yell at the guy and I communicate my hatred, now I have no right to do that, but I don't violate the Torah prohibition of don't hate your fellow Jew in your heart. What is prohibited is acting as if everything's, you know, being fake around the person. Acting as if you like the person or neutral to the person, but harboring this deep hatred. Now, why do you think the Torah prohibition forbid? Don't hate your fellow Jew. Why does it specify don't hate your fellow Jew in your heart?
Yeah, I guess because that's how it, maybe the argument is that's how it builds. If it's kept in like that, then it just gets worse and has the potential to accelerate into to something much more extreme.
Correct. In other words, when a person has hatred in their heart about a fellow Jew, what they tend to do is, let's say a person went out to dinner with people, and the person brought up an embarrassing story. Okay, like let's say a guy got laid off or fired from a company, and he brings it up in a joking, makes a joke out of it, which of course is a very touchy subject, and he never goes to the, what will typically people do concerning that situation? Some people will speak to the other person privately, and that's a very mature person, and that's of course the Torah way. But why will a person not try to discuss it and work that through with the other person?
Yeah, because people don't like conflict, so that's the whole thing.
They don't like confrontational experiences. It's just something which is anathema to them. That's number one. But there are other possibilities as well. What else?
Maybe some people don't even think of it, you know, that they just makes them bitter and angry, and there's not a sense, even if you went to the person and said this, that they would react in a favorable way. It would only make things worse.
Right. So, now sometimes that is true, but they typically will not give it any kind of possibility, because already they start the process of demonization. This guy's such a lowlife. I can't talk to such a guy. He's beneath me. It becomes an intolerable point. Which, of course, I think is part of the Torah trying to think, because part of the Jewish people is trying to create a sense of we are one family. we're a family, we're going to fight, but we have to try to keep the relationship going, so we have to resolve it. We have to discuss out the issues. Now, that's another factor. Let's say I go speak to the guy, and I'm going to point out this error, this mistake, and he's going to then deny it. He's going to deny it, and then not only that, he's going to double down. He's going to bring up other things about me. You know what I'm saying? He's not going to accept it. You know what I'm saying? In other words, the situation might deteriorate worse. He might bring up things about me that I don't want to hear. You know what I'm saying? In our, if you're going to start unpacking the gripes and issues, you know, people don't like to hear negative assessments. So it's another factor. Right. Now, the midst of doing this whole kind of rebuke, you got to do it privately, in a, do it in a way that doesn't get defensive, in a way that, you know, that in a soft tone, in not like you're indicting the person, so you'll be successful. You know, pointing out the error, you know, indirectly, identifying the point that maybe he didn't, he wasn't realized that I was sensitive to that issue. You know what I mean? There's a whole, there's an art to bringing up these types of things, and it's not so simple. Now, the Torah is concerned about that, you know, they're worried that if I bring it up, the status quo is going to actually go bad. But ultimately, the mitzvah is the person said something that bothers you, insults you, or actually harms you in any kind of way, financially or reputationally. You have an obligation, a Torah obligation, a mitzvah, to speak to that person privately and broker the reconciliation. If the person recognizes the defect and asks you to forgive him, and if you, and you sense that it is in fact authentic, it is genuine, then you have a obligation to forgive them, which is also difficult. People have a hard time forgiving. Which, of course, which is the intriguing question, does Yaakov ever ask Esau for forgiveness?
I don't believe so, no.
No, if you look through the entire, then that's the focus of next week's Parsha. He does not. He bribes him. He submits to him. He bows to him seven times. He arouses his the brotherly love again. So therefore, basically, in a certain sense, that aggression does not become an animating factor, right? And but they don't. But then he basically says, "Oh well, let's join together. Let's, you know, let's get the family back together. I miss you, you know. We'll cut, you know." He says, "Oh, I got young kids. I can't go as fast. You guys, you run up ahead, and I'll catch up to you." And never does. And basically, Yaakov ghosts on Esau. So the relationship, by the way, never improved. Basically, which of course, basically, Yaakov doesn't deem that Esav is somebody who a broken reconciliation is possible. Now, by the way, is he right? Is he wrong? Torah is mute about that. I guess a good question is, would a couple that practice rebuking improve or worsen the relationship? What do you say? In general life.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's... I think the answer is it will worsen the relationship. I understand it flies in the face of what's been discussed, but rebuke is not a good word.
Well, rebuke is a translation of hochacha, or... So I like the word... You know, bring up the issue.
Right. You know,
bring up the area of the discontent. The issue of the dis. Right. Bring up the issue.
Right. So So the communication. Yeah. So that should improve. Right. But not in the sense of rebuke.
Right.
Rebuke is more of a dressing down.
The,
you know.
Rebuke is the word hochech tochiach samisecha. The word rebuke has a very harsh connotation. It's, you know, it's somebody taking one party taking the position of the superior and pointing out the flaws and the defects and the errors of the inferior. That's what the word hochacha means. But really, the goal is to really, you know, share with the person why they feel, you know, harmed, insulted, slighted, etc. But with a goal to try to make the relationship whole again, you know, or get it out, you know, or get it out there and discuss it out and try to improve the relationship as best as possible. Now, you're right, but, you know, in a certain sense, it depends what the issues are. Obviously, if a husband has to go to the wife, if the wife confronts him that the husband's been cheating, okay, she has a right to feel upset and violated and that the husband has been cheating on her. There might not be able to get a reconciliation back to that same state. That relationship might be completely destroyed. You know, they don't hate each other in their hearts anymore, and they understand the position. The person apologizes, but that, or it could also be like this. Sometimes if a person does something wrong, you know, party A harms party B. They discuss it. Party B admits the wrongdoing, pleads the person for party A for forgiveness. Party A accepts the person and accepts and grants them the forgiveness. But the relationship, the rapport, is never the same. You know what I'm saying? Forgiveness does not mean that you're now the same level of friendship. It means that the issue has been discussed, worked out, and resolved and forgiven, but doesn't mean that you want to hang out with that person anymore. You know what I'm saying? Doesn't mean the relationship is good.
Right.
That's also an important point. In other words, a person can, you can have, in other words, you can say, like, for example, in couples, like they say, they're reconciled, but they don't want to be married anymore. Or you see that all the time. In other words, we discussed the issues, we each person identified where we went wrong, we discussed it, we forgive each other, but we realize that we cannot no longer be that caliber of friends who can actually live as husband and wife anymore.
Right, yep. Amicable separation.
Right, the amicable, right. That's a good situation, right. But dropping down the volume down from that situation to, let's say, you know, a husband was insensitive and says a comment to his wife that makes her feel really bad, and she brings it up, and the guy recognizes, you know, I was insensitive, I was wrong, I apologize, I shouldn't have said that, and, you know, I was being an idiot, you know. That's it. Would you forgive me? You know what I'm saying? So those kind of, you know, the dealing with the daily slights and conflicts of daily life of being a married person, I would say, so not only is it a mitzvah, but critical for the ongoing health of the relationship, because both parties are going to mess up. And both parties, since you have such a close relationship and you live in such close proximity, to discuss things out is critical. Will be initially painful, but it will be for the long-term health and viability of the relationship. It's critical for a good relationship. So that really is the, interestingly enough is that Rivka, A, underestimated the wrath of Esav, overestimated the power of the brotherly love, and thought this was going to blow over, and did not. Doesn't mean that she said that she's going to forgive, that she thought he's going to forgive him, but doesn't mean that he may not forgive Yaakov, but he's not going to what? Kill him. You know, there's a difference. You know, you could be upset at somebody and have an unreconciled relationship. Doesn't mean that you want to take out a 45, you know, take out a shotgun and kill them. You know,
right.
Those are not the same thing.
Yeah.
So that's the deal. All right, so it's a little taste of the parsha, and bring up the very important thing of that. This mitzvah, most people have a hard time really doing. They don't like confrontation. They don't want to, maybe that the confrontation is going to bring out bad stuff that we don't talk about. It requires that, you know, he's the person wrong me. I got to come to this person. they should be coming to me. You know, that it becomes an ego battle. And then by left, if it's not discussed, there's the ongoing demonization of the person, and therefore talking bad about that person when the person's not around. That guy's a real low life, a B, you know what I mean? Sort of the trashing of the guy when they're not around, which of course, the whole mitzvah is has one ultimate objective, is to create a state of harmony in the Jewish people. Because we're a family and we're not going to always get along. So and ultimately, even in the family of nations. So it's a foundational idea, a foundational mitzvah. And, you know, I would say that for many people, that mitzvah of working out reconciliations with people that have wronged them is much harder to mitzvah than keeping kosher. Because it really, really requires an emotionally, for them to, you know, endure sort of a psychological pain that, you know, an ego crushing pain that people are very resistant toward.
Right.
So it's a tough mitzvah, you know, but it's a mitzvah that if done properly produces tremendous dividends for the individual, for the personal growth, obviously for the growth of the relationships they have with their family and friends, and ultimately for the Jewish nation. So it's just a critical mitzvah to really think about. It's really very vital, very vital. All right, Dan, have a great day. And blessings from Jerusalem.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much.
All the best.
Take care.
Bye-bye.